dealing with an extremely important subject. Of course, I presume that all subjects in the Scripture are important, but this subject touches the very foundations of a faith. Getting down to the most essential issue of how do human beings ever really identify with God? You know, how can we be sure about things? How can we know? What pleases God? What satisfies God as far as our human efforts are concerned? As we talked about this subject, it is not with the presumptuous assumption that we know everything or anything in the flesh. We've prepared the instruments as best we can, but in the ultimate, only God can reach us. And of course, I've talked to you often about the human psyche, the physiological and psychological processes of mind, because that's where we live. To ignore those processes would be perhaps to ignore the engine of the automobile whilst we depend on gasoline and the spirit of the driver. We've got to deal with those things, but at the same time with the assumption that only the spirit and power of God can really lift us to his level. We are only lifted from the human to the divine by the spirit of Christ within us, not just by the religious knowledge of Christ, not by religious experience, but by the deeper thing, the spirit of Christ, which prevails in spite of the emotional ups and downs and upheavals. I'm a realist about the matter of emotions. I know that in the flesh, you just simply can't always control the emotions. You feel what you feel. All I could ever do is put guilt on you for feeling badly. You know, if I tried to convince you that if you're a Christian, you shouldn't feel anything negative, all I would do is put guilt feelings on you. I wouldn't change your feelings at all. We all know the hopeless feelings that come from time to time in various kinds of circumstances and feelings that seem not at all like victorious Christian feelings, but they're just human feelings. We try to recognize those things. Of course, the subject we're dealing with, and we're dealing with last week, was the priesthood of the believer. And as we pointed out, the idea of priesthood involves the religious elements, always, whatever language, whatever culture. When people talk about priests, they mean something that has to do with a very religious aspect. Now, I think we have applications of the word priest that may seem a little ignoble. So, for example, in the 60s, we had a gentleman who was identified as the priest of the dropout set, Timothy Leary, who was the priest of the drug culture, especially relative to LSD and some of the more disintegrative drugs, I would say. We all know that that's a secondary application. By the same token, we can say that the Bible of the mechanics trade is the major manual. What you call it, the Bible of the mechanic, and you have the Bibles of various crafts and skills. Or what. But we all know that that's a secondary usage. We're not applying it seriously. But the word priest always applies to a religious activity, especially with reference to those religions that relate to God. And the priest is, whether we're talking about God's many or the true God, a priest usually stands between the people and God. Now in the Old Testament, you had the high priest. In the first instance, Aaron, who was the first Levitical priesthood, that is with the formal priesthood. Now, prior to Aaron, of course, you had Melchizedek identified as a priest, but he was a very special figure, not in the tradition of the Levitical priesthood or the priesthood that God had ordained in the law of Moses. But that was the original priest. He stood between the people and God. And I shifted into that because I wanted you to understand where I was coming from in the beginning, talking about emotions. I wanted to qualify, you probably lost you down there. I wanted to qualify our area of concern, our subject matter. We're talking about the priesthood. Now, I'm going back to pick up the original introductory threads when I say that dealing with the human emotions is an extremely important part of our concept of salvation and of what in the New Testament is regarded as the priesthood of the believer. So in our understanding of the identity we have with God, we are cast, according to the Bible, we are cast in a characterization of being each one priests. Now, that means, of course, that we are fundamentally able to ourselves offer sacrifices to God. That's what it's all about. And according to 1 Peter 4, which we read last week, we are able to offer living sacrifices. That I will explain to you. Meanwhile, you say to yourself, if I am a priest, why am I feeling all of these emotional turmoils? Why am I upset? Why do I lose my temper? Why do I feel discouraged, despondent, depressed? Why do I have illicit feelings and feelings that are not always sound? Why? See, if we're priests, I've tried in many different ways to help you understand the difference between the priesthood or the interaction we have with God and the Spirit and the expressions of that interaction that occur to us in the flesh. It is so vital, however, because a lot of times salvation is put on a feeling basis. It is not theologically demanded, but normally assumed that if you have a salvation experience, something good will happen to you. That is, something happens that makes you feel different about things. But that, of course, leaves in confusion large numbers of people who do not tend to have those kinds of feelings. But it not only is in the original salvation thing. You have continuous testimonials. I'm going to call them that instead of testimonies per se, because a testimonial is a valid term that has to do with one's appreciation of a certain thing. So one gives a testimonial for Oxydol soap or Ford automobiles or whatever. If he has enough faith in Ford automobiles, he gives a testimonial about it. And you may say, well, you're getting very pedantic here. But the reason I make a distinction is our word testimonies has a cast to it. We have impregnated the word testimonies with an aura that gives it a kind of religious significance. And the reason that it's an unfortunate thing to me when I look at it, there are those people who are the testimony people, and there are those people who are the not testimony people. And the testimony people seem always to be the victorious ones, you know, that are ready to pop up and say how lovely it is and how much things have happened in their lives that have been for good and so forth. I remember a certain situation in which one was giving continuously great testimonies about how God was helping in business matters, whereas another man in the same group who was probably just probably one of the most faithful, substantial brothers in the group, was always having trouble in his business. And this was a great problem to him. He felt that if he was really a Christian, if the Lord really with him, he should have as many remarkable deliverances as the other brother. It wasn't very long before the testimony brother, whom we're contrasting with the not testimony brother, the testimony brother went completely off the track, doesn't do anything now or go anywhere. I cannot say he's not a Christian, but he just totally collapsed as far as his Christian experience was concerned. And because I had told the other brother that, and he understood from our continual discussions of the matter, that The way of the believer is not always smooth. That the business success is not always the criterion for our spiritual condition or the gauge of our spiritual condition. That's a patent point. That's something that is a truism, actually, in Christendom, and deeply or continuously supported by Paul, for example, as well as Jesus and Peter and others, that people who are Christians do not always have a smooth time in this world. They do not always have great business successes. They do not always have things that are something to pop up and give a great testimony about. The reason I say that is because there is a large segment of Christendom that feels, unless you are ready to pop up and give a testimony about yourself, about the Lord's dealings with you, you're not very victorious. They would hardly deny your salvation, but you're certainly not very victorious. Well, that is really contrary to the facts. I bring the whole subject up because of this issue of feelings, and I have to bring that up because I'm talking about the priesthood of the believers, and there are lots of people that might wonder, how can I call myself a priest when I have all these fleshly problems and turbulences and ups and downs and bad feelings? I need a priest. I'm not a priest myself. This is what the feeling might be. Well, I want to divest you of that immediately. It seems from the constant references to such things in the Bible, that is, as to the temple and the priesthood of the individual, that we do have a temple thing in our lives. We do have our worship center. Paul says we are temples of God. That means that we have a sanctuary within us where Christ dwells and where we go for our communion with Him, and which is the storehouse, if you will, or the source of our spirit realities. What we have with God is a world apart from what we have with ourselves, whom we often view as very wanting in many ways, very wanting. We don't like ourselves very much often. Sometimes young ladies, we had a few in our household, look at themselves in the mirror when they're trying to fix their hair or something, and sometimes they will stick their tongue out at themselves. This is a very personal little thing. Girls look at themselves, they think they're terribly ugly. And I've had girls talk to me that have said they feel very ugly, they feel very unattractive and so forth, and I've had to help buoy their spirits up by showing them that that's not true. But I suspect that no matter how physically attractive a girl might be, she always think she isn't attractive, or often think she isn't. What we feel about ourselves is often quite distorted by the moods of the moments, distorted by the natural tendency, I think, to question ourselves. One reason why I try to be very careful about beating the saints, the Christians, I don't like to use the black snake, well, because I think you probably punish yourselves enough from day to day. To the tendency to feel less than we are is more pronounced among Christians than the tendency to feel that we are more than we are. It does happen. There are Christian people that feel a little arrogant about themselves. Certain people you think about and you say, well, that person's very arrogant. You might be surprised to know how much of a fear inferiority complex they have, how much the opposite is true. Sometimes people cover the inferiority by a bravado, by an externalization of things, and they you find the life of the party type, you know what I mean, the outspoken, aggressive life of the party, almost invariably that covers a very deep-rooted inferiority complex. At best, the way we come across to others is almost invariably faulty in terms of what we really are within ourselves. What my father used to say, and he probably got it from a long tradition of people in the South, that we hurt in one place and grunt in another. You think your toe is hurting, and maybe it's your shoulder. You never know. You know, Just like an automobile, you can hear a noise in the car and the automobile, and it may be in the opposite end of the car from where it seems to be coming from. Okay? But it's a commonality, a commonplace of truths about human beings, that our evaluation of ourselves, who we are, what we are, is invariably faulty, but not nearly so faulty as other people's evaluation of ourselves. Now, the answer to that, of course, is that we simply don't put any weight on that aspect of ourselves. I'm not going to stop you from having feelings about yourselves and others. As well could we stop the flow of Niagara's to stop a human being from feeling a given way. In fact, if we interfere with our feelings, we may wind up being deceived or phony. The person that puts on a Cheshire Cat type smile in the social soiree and when the moment the guests have gone turns into a thundercloud. That's common, isn't it? Man and wife, excepting, of course, all people among us here, may be very much fighting each other and hateful and so forth, and then the moment the guests arrive, everything is just lovely and sweet and great, and then the guests leave and rawr, back on the wildcat scene again. Common thing, human behavior, that is true. It's all deception. If we try to control our feelings, which, you know, is something everybody tries to do, but we can turn out to be phony. Now, I've always distinguished between controlling your feelings and controlling your actions. Please bear that distinction in mind. I don't think we ought to act ugly to people just because we feel ugly. I'm not saying that for a minute. I don't think the husband and wife ought to go on fighting while the guests are there for dinner. I think that would be déclassé, if they might say in old Paris. I'm saying that you really can't falsify your feelings without being phony with yourself. But you can deal with how you feel in a proper way. See, I've said that. You can't help how you feel, but you can help how you deal with how you feel. See that? So you may feel bad, but you don't let anybody else in on it unless there's some reason to let them in on it. I've always said you don't let people in on your bad moods unless you're ready to talk to them about it. Don't take your bad moods out on somebody else unless you're ready to tell them why you're acting badly or share it with them. Since they have nothing to do with your feeling, they're in much the disadvantage because you know why you feel like you do and they don't. So you're really putting them in a very unfortunate position. So I've often said, if you're going to go around acting like a thundercloud, you better explain something about it. I just say, but I don't want to talk about it. You know. Now, on the other hand, you don't have to feel phony. You don't have to, as I say, you don't have to put on a big show of happiness when you're feeling bad, but you can at least say to the person that's concerned about it, well, I'm having a bad time at the moment, and I'll talk to you about it when I'm ready. To say, for example, it has nothing to do with you. That's very important. You may ask, how does this have to do with so noble a theme as the priesthood? I'm going to say to you that I construct buildings. I don't just throw up stage props. In other words, when I construct a building, I've got to start from the foundation. And in order for you to be a successful priest of Christ, you have to understand what you are as a not priest of Christ, what you are in the flesh, so that you can deal with it and not feel phony about it, you see. So I'm kind of exploring once again this realm of human feelings and interactions with one another, because we always have trouble with one another. So human relationships are almost invariably out of joint somewhere or at some time. Almost any human relationship has its ups and downs. And any human person has the good and the bad moods and so forth. So it's a very important aspect of our lives. And how can you be a priest when you don't feel religious or you don't feel good about yourself or good about others? How can you be nevertheless a priest of God? So we're talking about emotions a little bit. And I'm just throwing in some sidelines here. And I'm saying in regard to your relation to other people, I had just said don't put your burden on others unless you're willing to share it with them. You can be in a mood that is serious or depressing. Or you can be depressed, for example, And when you're with somebody who knows you, and they know you're depressed, and you're feeling depressed, at least they need to know the general parameters of that depression. It's very often that maybe a husband might feel that something he has done or said has caused this depression with his wife. And she needs to let him know, at least, that it has nothing to do with him, and vice versa. He comes home, he maybe leaves her in the morning and everything is fine, comes home in the evening and everything is turned around and she's feeling very bad and so forth. He wants to know what's the matter. She says, I don't want to talk about it. I'm saying instead of that, say, well, I'm having some difficulties and it has nothing to do with you, and we'll talk about it when I can, or something like that, you see. Now, once again, the theme is human emotions are erratic, undependable. We don't even understand ourselves, much less one another. We are not able to evaluate ourselves adequately, and Paul says that. He says, I judge not myself. Now, in the midst of this great melee, which differs from a milieu in that a melee is a battle, a struggle, I use the word milieu quite often, meaning the circumstances of our life. The melee, M-E-L-E-E, is a battleground. We are on a battlefield often in our lives, in our emotions, in our relation to other people. In the midst of this, there is a city of refuge. There is a sanctuary. There's a place to retreat. And that is our spirit. The spirit within us is the temple where Christ dwells. Paul says that to the Corinthians. We are temples of the Holy Spirit. Now, you are a temple. The temple is no more contained in terms of the temple is no more the buildings. The temple of God, as it was erected in Jerusalem, was a temple not because of the stones. The stones did not make the temple. The stones were the necessary vessel. The sanctuary was within the stones. It didn't matter whether the temple were made of goat skins, as it was back in the desert, or it was made of marble, as it was in the days of Herod's temple in Jerusalem. It didn't matter. The thing that was important was what was in the temple, the sanctuary. That is, the spirit. The temple was where the people met God. Now, from time to time, the temple, which had been quite ornate in its construction in the days of Solomon, for example, that temple was glorious in its construction, overlaid with gold in many parts, real gold, not just fake junk jewelry gold, real gold. And from time to time, in order to pay tribute to surrounding powers, the children of Israel had to strip the gold off the temple and use it to pay tribute. But that did not make the sanctuary any less glorious, any less serviceable, any less the meeting place of Christ, of God, the Spirit of God. Now, we have a temple within. That temple is our spirits. And that temple is housed in a faulty vessel. And from time to time, the gold, which is the glory of that vessel, gets stripped away. And people who may be very noble on occasion and be the essence of spiritual grace and charm may on other occasions appear to be barren of that charm. There are many times when human beings fail to fulfill God's desire for them in their life. Many times when they make mistakes, they get out of order. David made some grand mistakes, as we have talked about. That is, large mistakes. We've talked about David quite a bit here of late. And he made some grave mistakes. But that did not strip away with the gold. It did not strip away the Spirit of God within. At least, not permanently, because David prayed the Lord would restore a right spirit within him, which he did, apparently. God did, because the remaining writings of David reflect the fact that God had restored his spirit. Now, David, during the time of his disobedience, might have gone through a period also where the glory of his inner spirit was greatly tarnished. I do not know that. Might have been so. Might have been obvious to people that knew him. But at least it was a temporary condition, and the Spirit of God was restored. So now we are a temple of the Holy Spirit within us. We are not ourselves. We are not our own. We are bought with a price. God owns this temple within us. And if the external factors of your life may be ever so distressing to you, desolate, desecrated, or whatever, you can always repair to the temple within, in your spirit, your mind, and worship Christ there, bringing to him the sacrifice that the priest is given to bring. That sacrifice, as we read to you in 1 Peter, was a sacrifice, a living sacrifice, as a matter of fact. And he said that we are given to offer spiritual sacrifices. As I had read it to you before, we are a priesthood. We are given to offer sacrifices to God in the Spirit, and he says that these are living sacrifices. Now, this is the nature of our salvation, nature of our faith, that we are to offer spiritual sacrifices or living sacrifices. I won't read that now, but the passage read last week from Peter, he said that we are a priesthood who offer living sacrifices. What does that mean? That means that when you go to pray, let's say the day has been a very disorganized day, a very devastating day perhaps, you've made many mistakes, you're not happy with yourself, but you come at night and things are in a turmoil and you come before God in your spirit and you pray. You do not need to stay away no matter what the problems were during that day. You don't need to stay away. You don't need to feel that you're not worthy to come to. Of course, none of us are worthy. But you come with the sacrifice. What is the living sacrifice? It is you, your life. I belong to you, Lord. I may not have pleased you very well, but I belong to you. And I want to talk to you about this. And when things are going against you, things not of your own doing, and you are facing heartache or distress or sorrow, whatever it is, you come into the temple of your spirit. That is, you commune with God on your bed or walking on the beach or wherever you are, whatever you're doing. In the still of the night, you repair to your inner sanctuary. And there you meet with Christ. And you bring your living sacrifice, yourself, your spirit, your soul. You belong to Christ. And you share with him whatever it is that troubles you, whatever it is that is in your heart, whatever circumstances have taken place, good, bad, and indifferent. You are privileged to do that. In the Old Testament, only the priest could do that, you see. Only the priest could come, and that with a dead thing, in a sense, blood, a dead sacrifice. We come with a living sacrifice, ourselves. We are bought with a price. Our concern is to glorify God, as Paul suggests. We do not belong to the world. We are not interested as much in their evaluation of us as in God's evaluation of us. The fact that we come to him and we care what he thinks about us identifies us with him. All the feelings of the flesh can never touch that. You may pray and you may go back and try to go to sleep or whatever it is, and things churn within you. You feel bad. That does not negate what takes place in your spirit. It's only the fleshly eruptions, this volcanic process, So the answer is not that I can tell you in a moment your feelings will be assuaged and you will feel great if you only pray. I can't tell you. I wish that I could. I think you feel a lot better. You certainly feel more at peace while you're praying. But the mind is a hard thing to control. And you think you have everything under control, and then these feelings erupt. You seem not to be able to get hold of them. Never mind, don't worry about it. Like the old gorilla behind the bars may rant and rage and shake the cage, but it can't get out and do any damage. So your feelings may rage within you, but they're in behind bars, so to speak. You feel bad, but this human thing within us will not be able to destroy the spirit. That's why I say you can have a sanctuary there where you can talk to God, no matter whom else you cannot talk to. Maybe you cannot talk to anyone else. You can talk to God, and you don't have to talk to him in religious terms. Your flesh may rage at him. Well, you shouldn't, but your flesh rages at other people. Perhaps your flesh rages at your parents or your family or your friends or whatever. But that's all the flesh. We are priests. We are a kingdom of priests because our true citizenship is a spiritual one. And we have put that process in motion. When we become Christians, when we accept Christ, we join that kingdom. But that is a world apart from the ragings of the flesh. Now, it is not to say we ought to rage in the flesh. It's only to say that the flesh has its turbulence, and if we don't understand it, we may think that that is the gauge of our spirituality. That's what I want to get over to you. Whatever the flesh is, it is not to say you can let it go and do whatever it wants. I'm not saying don't control yourselves. I'm not saying it doesn't matter what you do. I'm only saying when it comes to evaluating yourself as a priest, you are a priest and you serve a priestly temple which is in your spirit, and that remains stable and strong in spite of the turbulence of your natural person. Well, I think we'll stop there.